You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. It's Monday, August 2nd, 2010. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Connie Mae Fowler, who was a visiting faculty member at the Vermont College of Fine Arts last month. We tried to air this show a week ago and had some technical difficulties. Hopefully this time we'll have no problems. An award-winning novelist, memoirist, and screenwriter, Connie Mae Fowler is the author of 6 novels and 1 memoir. Her most recent novel, How Clarissa Burden Learned to Fly, was published in April by Grand Central Publishing. Her novels include Sugar Cage, River of Hidden Dreams, The Problem with Murmur Lee, Remembering Blue, and Before Women Had Wings. She's been the recipient of the Chautauqua South Literary Award, the Southern Book Critics Circle Award, and the Frances Buck Award from the League of American Pen Women. 3 of her novels have been Dublin International Literary Award nominees. She adapted Before Women Had Wings for an Emmy-winning film starring Oprah Winfrey and Ellen Barkin. Domestic violence shelters and family violence organizations have honored Connie Mae Fowler with numerous awards. In 2009, she received the first annual Peace, Love, and Understanding Award from WMNF Community Radio. From 1997 to 2003, she directed the Connie Mae Fowler Women Wings Foundation, an organization dedicated to aiding women and children in need. From 2003 to 2007, she served as the Irving Bachelor Professor of Creative Writing at Rollins College and directed their award-winning visiting author series, Winter with the Writers. A Florida native, Connie Mae Fowler teaches writing workshops and seminars globally. She's the founder of Below Sea Level, Full Immersion Workshops for Serious Writers, and she serves on the faculty of the Afghan Women's Writing Project. When I spoke to her a couple weeks ago, we began by talking about how she became a writer.
I have always been a writer, and by that I mean always. My earliest childhood memories are of my mother and father having violent fights. I mean, every night they fought. And so my sister and I would huddle in our bedroom, and I would beg her to read to me, and she would. And I followed her finger down the page, and that's how I learned to read. But it's also where I learned that stories save lives and change lives. And so as soon as I could, I started writing. And I have very few memories of a time in my life when I didn't write.
So how did you start writing? Did you start with little stories, or...?
I was a scribbler savant. I wrote absolutely everything. I wrote songs, I would do little cartoons, I wrote poems. Didn't matter to me, I just read, and wrote. You know, probably none of it was any good, but it was still, you know, it was a very important part of... It's always been a really important part of who I am.
Right.
And the reading and writing have always gone hand in hand. And when I hear young writers say that they don't read, you know, my mouth falls open. It's like, well, then you're not feeding your brain, your intellect, your creativity. But books were so important at an early age. I mean, I realized what was happening. I mean, I think I did. And it wasn't just escape. Because of the way I grew up, you know, nobody said, oh, I love you, or you're a pretty little girl, or anything like that. They said just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And so in books, I found role models. You know, I figured out, wow, not everybody lives like this, and I want to be like the people in my books.
Yeah, that's amazing. And it sounds like nobody in your life was a writer. Is that...
No, but my father was a songwriter.
A songwriter.
Yeah.
Right.
And... You know, I mean, we come from very, very poor beginnings, and so, no, but I couldn't imagine anybody, like, I've been doing genealogy, and I discovered that I have some great-great-great-great-grandfather who is an itinerant preacher man, you know, going through the Appalachians, and his hair was as crazy as mine, you know, so I think that I come from very hard-scrabble people who, for many generations, their creativity was... embedded in just how do we survive.
Huh. And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Florida.
In Florida, so you've lived there your whole life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wanted to talk about How Clarissa Burden Learned to Fly, and I was wondering, when you set out to write this book, how might you have described your vision for it?
This book was a very, very organic process, and me learning the book as I wrote it. I mean, the first impulse was when I ran across a historical note about the 1819 land treaty that would cede Florida to the United States from Spain 2 years hence, and what a progressive place, relatively progressive place, Spanish Florida was compared to what was happening in the U.S. territories. So, for instance, black men could sit on juries. Women couldn't of any color, but black men could sit on juries. Slavery, while not illegal, was very, very much frowned upon. And women could own property, and none of those things existed in the U.S. territories. So Florida, even at that time, was a diverse place because of that. And they didn't know, people living there didn't know that this treaty had happened and that on one day, a perfectly fine June day or April day, it would be taken away from them, that they no longer had rights to the house that they built, that they were no longer allowed to be a free person. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That really haunted me. So I started creating a story around that, but I didn't want to do a historical novel per se. And then I came up with, I was reading a lot of Virginia Woolf, and I knew her name would be Clarissa Burton. I mean, it really started with little steps like that.
Right. And so when did the ghosts become part of what you were planning to do?
They just showed up.
Yeah.
There was the big rambling house. I knew I had the house, and I had a frame. I know I wanted the circular form of the novel. And as part of that was absolutely out of necessity, mm-hmm. because Clarissa is pretty isolated. And so there had to be other people that she interacted with. And so the ghost kind of naturally arose, and I had that historical background happening anyway. And I'm like, well, they're still there.
Right. Now, the novel all takes place in one day on the summer solstice. And I was wondering if that was difficult as a writer, confining the entire narrative to a single day. Was that hard, or did that just came about?
It was absolutely freeing.
Was it?
It was one of the most important decisions I made in the writing, mm-hmm. Because what it did was it gave me structure. And I'm dealing with a woman's life, and I really didn't want to write, you know, a life-to-death story.
Sure.
And I was trying to figure out what kind of time frame the story would work best. And I tried a few things, but it was like a whisper in my ear, 24 hours, 24 hours, 24 hours. And I'm like, okay, what the heck, I'm going to try it. And it really fell into place. It was a really important decision.
Did the book come quickly? You said it was a very organic process. Did you write it more quickly than you usually write?
I thought about it for a very long time. I mean, it had been back there in the primordial muck of my brain, kind of stewing. But the actual writing was probably about a year.
Uh-huh. Okay. Clarissa, at the beginning of the book, is having trouble getting through her work. And I was wondering if you were drawing on personal experience in writing this, in writing about, have you experienced times when your writing slowed down and deadlines froze you?
I haven't had the kind of block Clarissa has. I mean, Clarissa's, she has a almost fatal case of writer's block, and it's related to the anemic condition of her marriage and her emotional and spiritual life. So, but certainly there are times when I'm going, I don't have a clue what to write. What's the next word? those times aren't very happy times, but
right.
It's just part of the process, too.
Yeah, so you were able to draw on that to create her character, but it doesn't sound like you've had quite the paralysis.
I haven't been quite there.
And we'll come back to that subject at the end. I'm wondering if maybe this is a good time for you to read from the book.
Sure, I would love to. On June 21st, 2006, at 7 a.m., in a malarial crossroads named Hope, Florida, the thermometer old Mrs. Hickok had nailed to the Welcome to Hope sign 15 years prior read 92 degrees. It would get a lot hotter that day, and there was plenty of time for it to do so, this being the summer solstice. But 92 at 7 a.m., sunrise occurring only 3 hours earlier, suggested a harsh reckoning was in store for this swampy southern outpost. The weight of the humidity-laden situation pressed down on nearly all of the village's inhabitants, including its sundry wildlife. Squirrels, raccoons, possums, rats, deer, and one lone bobcat, each of whom immersed in its
way I grew up. You know, nobody said, oh, I love you, or you're a pretty little girl, or anything like
that. Noses twitching, tails snapping, all steeling themselves against the inevitable onslaught of the day's hellish heat. Hope's only living being to appear unfazed by the rising mercury was Marissa Burden, a 35-year-old woman who'd moved to the North Florida hamlet 6 months prior with her husband of 7 years. Trapped as she was in a haze of insecurities and self-doubt, and being long divorced from her animal consciousness, she peered out her open window into her rose garden and felt an undoing coming on that was totally unrelated to the weather. It was as if her brainstem, corpuscles, gallbladder, nail cuticles, the mole of her left shoulder, the scar on her knobby shin,
kind of stewing. But the actual writing was probably about a year.
We're about to surrender. But to what? She did not know. She watched her husband, a multimedia artist who dabbled in painting, filmmaking, sculpture, pottery, and photography, as long as his muse wore no clothes, alternately sketch and photograph a sweating young woman. With the exception of a silver ring piercing her belly button, the woman stood in the bright light of morning amid Clarissa's roses, as naked as the moment she was born. Clarissa leaned windward to get a better look. Barefoot and still wearing the clothes she had slept in, a rumpled t-shirt and dirt-stained shorts, she tapped her finger on the screen's dusty mesh, wondering what it felt like to be her husband's muse. Was the young woman racked with insecurity, fearing the artist was casting judgment with each stroke of his charcoal pencil? Or was she empowered, fully aware of the spell that flesh cast on weak men? Her husband, Igor Iggy Dupuis, paused from his sketching and wiped perspiration from his bald pate and big face. "You have beautiful skin, even when you sweat." Clarissa took in every lyrical syllable her husband uttered, and while unhappy with their intent, even if it was a harmless observation, Clarissa had never grown tired of her husband's accent. South African by birth, of Dutch ancestry, and American by choice, Iggy was actually born Igo Praetorian, but changed his last name, favoring a French influence, to distance himself from his birth country's racial past. She appreciated that in him. It was something they had in common, both coming from a land of racial sins and both feeling it forever necessary to let people know that the old politic was never their politic. He was a tall, strapping man with hands twice the size of Clarissa's. It was one of the things that caused her to fall in love with him 8 years ago, the stature that far outpaced her own.
Thank you very much for reading that.
You're welcome.
I want to talk about her husband, but before we talk about his character, I noticed that you talked about she had lost touch with her animal consciousness. And there is consciousness in the insects and animals in the book. And I was just curious how that came to be. If you wrote those words and then suddenly thought that you were going to imbue the animals with consciousness, or if it came about differently.
I think that part of the novel, and I only realized this, you know, as I'm writing, and I'm going, oh, wow, look at that, look at what I just did, is that there's so much going on about both the seen and unseen worlds. Mm-hmm. And so, and that's very much the case with Clarissa, you know, what she's aware of and what she's not aware of. And she's sublimated so much. And so her creativity comes out in other ways, like this, you know, this the ovarian shadow women. Mm-hmm. It's like the Greek chorus inside herself and her superhero meanderings. And so it's a theme that just kept popping up. And I think the creative process is so mysterious. It's as if it's there in our brains. It's all there. And I think that sometimes we get in our own way. Mm-hmm. We don't just sit down and let the story flow. I mean, because we can fix all the craft issues after the fact, but the story's in there. And I don't think that, I mean, if we consciously try to construct metaphor and image structures and those sorts of things that English professors love to talk about, They come off as contrived. I think that's why writers so often talk about an organic process. Mm-hmm. That we've got it in our brains, and we're not necessarily thinking about it with our conscious brain. So sometimes we do, surely, and sometimes we become aware of it. But I really do think it's all in there, and we just have to allow it to happen rather than us pushing it.
And so do you tend to write a full first draft and just sort of like see where it takes you before you let yourself do any editing?
No, because I'm just an obsessive reviser. I can't stop.
And are these sort of substantive revisions, or are you mostly just tinkering as you go?
Sometimes they're very substantive because I'm trying to figure out what the story's about.
Okay.
And other times I'm tinkering and wasting my time. And there is a lot to be said for just getting the story down.
Mm.
And I have to push myself sometimes to do that. Every book's been different, though. I mean, with my first book, Sugar Cage, I really just ran from start to finish. And I think because I wasn't sure if I could do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so at least when I had that first draft, no matter how crazy and rough it was, you know, it was down on paper.
And it was an accomplishment.
Well, and you know, suddenly it was a soft landing. You know, when you start a novel, you feel like you've just jumped off a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know whether you're going to have a hard or soft landing.
Mm-hmm.
And you're hoping for the best.
Now, I'm curious, because you've written a number of novels. Has the process become more time-consuming with each novel? Do you spend more time on a first draft with each successive one, or is it not?
You know, that's really interesting. I think that I have begun to write more careful first drafts, and I don't know if that's doing me any good or not. You know, I kind of fantasize sometimes about the early days when I was just like, but I love words, and I love how words work together, and so that's part of the joy of writing. Is just to play with words.
Yeah.
And so sometimes that the process is slow on the front end, you have less work to do on the back end.
Uh-huh.
You know, you can either write a complete mess of a first draft and then spend a lot of time working, or you can be more careful throughout and not have so much cleanup.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about Clarissa's husband. I found him to be a total creep.
Yes.
So I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about writing a hateful character.
Well, you know, he's a total creep, but he's not a caricature.
Uh-huh.
You know.
No, I agree. And actually, that's clear even in this section that you just read. You know, she sees things about him that she admires or that she did when she met him. And I think that makes him a more complicated. He's not completely hateful.
Well, there had to be a reason why she fell in love with him. And sometimes we fall in love with not such good people because of things that we've been through. And we don't have enough self-esteem, or we didn't see it. You know, I mean, nobody falls in love without being insane. I mean, we chemically go mad. You know, it's a necessary part of perpetuating the species. But that was a really an important decision to put at the front of the book. The moment they met, mm-hmm. and that kind of it was a sweet seduction, although you could still see that he was arrogant.
Yes.
You know, but I was very insistent on making sure that he was complex, but I in no way wanted him to be likable.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked it. She's able just to dismiss what happens at the end. You know, she's like, I don't care what happens to him. And that's a great place for her to be.
I was interested that you made him South African. Where did that come from?
Well, you know, there's certainly a thread in the book that is about oppression.
Mm-hmm.
And I've often been fascinated with similarities between the American South and what happened in South Africa. And also the way there are people who to this day are apologists for that era in both South Africa and the American South. And so since that was going, I mean, it's set in the South, and I have this ghost story where this horrible thing happens, mm-hmm. to this multicultural family in the 1820s, that I thought it would be a really interesting comparison.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, I mean, he ends up being a major hypocrite, and that just seemed to fit with the things that Clarissa was becoming aware of and learning.
Mm-hmm. The novel has quite a sense of magic to it. Is that always present in your writing?
It's present in quite a few of the books, yeah. I mean, in Sugar Cage, Inez Temple is a seer. She has a weeping eye, and she knows something horrible is going to happen when the eye begins to weep. And Soleil Marie is a voodoo mambo, and she actually flies and rescues her lover, who's in Vietnam. And you don't know whether it's a... whether it's her fantasy or for real.
No. Which is another part of the magic that takes place. Also, there's a lot of that in this book.
Yeah.
Fantasy.
And so, yeah, you know, in River of Hidden Dreams, Mr. Sammy has a magic chicken, Miss Raison, and it keeps popping up. But I had a very magical childhood. I mean, I was raised by women who absolutely believed in ghosts, and the ghosts were, you know, around all the time. And we left, I think, two houses because my mother decided that the ghost had become malevolent, and we left all of our belongings and just took off. I mean, it was crazy. So that this bubbles up from my experience.
Did you grow up with a belief in ghosts?
Well, yeah, it was hard not to when everybody around you is going, oh, that happened because the ghost, and the dog's barking because the ghost's there, and the ghost visited me last night and told me this, that, and the other, and the ghost solved this problem. I mean, there were dead husbands and lovers and children and great aunts, and strangers showed up in the house as ghosts. I mean, that's what we believed.
One of your books, Before Women Had Wings, became a movie. And I was wondering if you were at all involved in the process of bringing that to the screen and how that was for you.
Yeah, I wrote the screenplay, and I didn't want to. When I was much younger, I was doing a lot of freelance work, and I had the honor to interview Alex Haley.
Uh-huh.
And it was great. They said, you have 15 minutes. And I'm like, okay, and I was just... you know, completely afraid. And after our 15-minute meeting, he said, well, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, nothing. He said, well, let's just sit down and talk. And so he was like, you know, the wise person telling the youngster, you know, meeting out advice. And he said, the one thing that I can tell you unequivocally is whatever you do, stay out of Hollywood. I mean, he just had a horrible experience. So mm-hmm. when they called and said, would you like to write the screenplay? Number one, I thought they were asking to be polite, and then I later found out no one in Hollywood
is polite.
They certainly wouldn't ask that question to be polite. And I said no, but they kept asking. And in the process of them asking, conversations developed where I began to realize that while they were very talented and very well-meaning and sincere, they didn't have the sensibility that it would require to make it seem like it really came from my book. So I finally gave in and said yes. And it was a great experience, a very difficult experience, but as a writer, it was, you know, novelists have such latitude. I mean, we can go interior, we can go exterior, we can go any place we want. And in a film, you have to stay exterior. And that was a real... My brain had to go through many gymnastic leaps to get there. But it was very, very good exercise for me.
And did you like the final product?
I'm ambivalent. I'm proud of it. It was a great experience. As I said, if I'd had the more power or influence, I would have done it differently.
Mm-hmm.
There are things that I'm not happy about with it. But overall, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they took great chances. I think that... The girl who plays Bird, Tina Majorino, is just absolutely amazing in it. So, yeah, I'm proud of it.
Yeah. I mean, it must have been sort of a thrill just to have that be happening in your life.
Oh, my gosh. It was like I stepped into somebody else's life.
Right.
Because I went out for the filming, and I'm sitting on the bed, and it's this giant bed, and my feet won't even touch the floor. And I'm like, what am I doing here? What am I doing here? And then the first day of principal photography, I went down to the set, but I stayed up by the food trailers. Something just wouldn't allow me to get down there. And somebody said, Oprah wants to see you. And so I go down, and it was as if God had just plopped me into my past. I mean, they just got it all right. I mean, I think they got things right that I hadn't even put on the page.
Wow.
And they were great. They stopped filming, and they showed me everything. And so I start crying. And that was in the morning.
at midnight, I'm still crying. I'm like, what is wrong with you? This is the best thing that's ever happened to you professionally. I mean, it's changing your life. And you're in your room crying. And it dawned on me, I didn't think I deserved it. Mm. You know, that little battered girl was right. still alive and well, and she was going, you don't deserve this, you don't deserve this. Mm. So that was a great epiphany.
Yeah. Wow. All right, so you're involved in so many things. I was looking at your website and seeing all these projects. So I wanted to just talk about a few of them. Mm-hmm. The first one is the Afghan Women's Writing Project.
Yes.
How did that come to be?
You know, writers are so wonderful and generous to one another, and I'm not sure how Masha Hamilton found me. I don't know how it happened. I think it's just writer to writer, and she contacted me and said, we've got this project going, and would you like to be part of it? And I'm like, absolutely, and it's just been amazing.
Yeah.
I'm very proud to be part of that project. I mean, these women are risking their lives just to tell their stories.
Yeah. So if you could just describe what the project is.
We are working with Afghan women. We're working with them through email and in order to help them craft their stories. And sometimes it's personal narrative, sometimes it's short stories, sometimes it's poetry. But it's all based on their experience being an Afghan woman in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And it's not without its dangers.
Sure.
This is a population of people who have been told that they have no voice, and if they try to have one, they can lose their lives. And so part of the project is to give them the confidence, without putting them in danger, to discover their voice, because when you do, things change.
Right.
And then we have their work on the website, the Afghan Women's Writers Project.
Okay. And that can be found on your website, which is ConnieMayFowler.com.
Yes.
And so can your I've Got a Secret postcard project. So what's the I've Got a Secret postcard project?
Well, you know, I wanted to do something that would be fun in conjunction with the publication of How Clarissa Burton Learned to Fly. And so I thought, well, what could that be? And I'm like, well, Clarissa is a woman who's full of secrets. She has secrets from herself, even. You know, and she has these spousal death scenarios that she's embarrassed and ashamed of, and she can't tell a soul that she spends most of her time in these various wild imaginings of her husband meeting his demise.
And she's always right there just about to save him. But she doesn't
And she doesn't actually off him.
Right.
She never offs him in right. the fantasies, but it just never works out. And so I thought, well, it would be really interesting just to have people, if they wanted to share their secrets. And I call it a postcard project because I thought most people would send in postcards, but people send in by email. Mm-hmm. And so I just copy their secret and put it in a file, and then I delete the email because I don't want any trace of who it is. But it's been very, very interesting, just a wide range of secrets. Mm-hmm. And some of them are quite moving. Others are infuriating.
What's an example of an infuriating secret?
Well, you know, being mean to someone,
oh, yeah.
you know. But others are very humbling.
Do you post them all?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So far, if I got one that was, you know, about a threat or something, I'm not going to post that. But I've posted them all. There are some still waiting to be posted. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have posted them all.
And then do people respond?
It's interesting. They've been responding on my Facebook site.
Oh.
They read it on my website and then go and respond on Facebook.
That's interesting. Hmm. And then what about the Connie Mae Fowler Women with Wings Foundation?
Well, that was a foundation that I ran for, I think, 7 years. And it arose out of the publication of Before Women Had Wings because I wanted to give something back to the community, although it was a community I just moved to. So I knew one person, and I said, and I had just met her, and I'm like, well, could you bring together a group of women so I can talk to them and figure out what it is I should be doing? And one of them was a city councilwoman, and she goes, well, you know, Refuge House, which is the domestic violence and rape crisis center in Leon County, Florida, serves 8 North Florida counties, which is the largest service area of any shelter in the state, serves 8 North Florida counties but has only 3 bedrooms.
Oh, my gosh.
That was my response. So I knew what I needed to do. And then that blossomed into this foundation, which, as I said, I ran for about 7 years, but it became my full-time job. Mm-hmm. You know, and we built shelters. We raised a lot of money, a lot of awareness, put down payment for a shelter in a little town called Perry, Florida, did a lot of legislative work. And then I realized I'm not a writer anymore. Mm-hmm. And so, with great sadness, but with pride, I closed the foundation, but I continue to do the work. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's just not full-time anymore.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you already had accomplished a lot, so that's fabulous.
Yeah, we did great things.
Yeah. So you recently wrote an article, Affirmation Etched in Vinyl, for the New York Times Modern Love column. The article deals with your father, who died when you were young, and your mother, who you describe in the article as a bitter person who never really helped you remember your father in any kind of loving way. This is a quote from that article. "Becoming a writer and creating fictional accounts driven by details I had stolen from other people did not fill the loss. In my experience, spectral memories only fed grief." I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that quote, and also just sort of what the article what happened.
Well, I think that quote is, you know, sometimes we write out of the need to fill a void, and when that void is about, you know, loss of someone you love, mm-hmm. you can write and you can write and write, but you're not going to resurrect them. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think I've written really interesting books that have been, in some ways, an attempt to resurrect him and understand him, and they stand on their own as books, but they're not my daddy,
right.
You know.
Right.
So that's what that quote means, I think. And I didn't have anything tangible of his life, mm-hmm. you know, not a tie clip, nothing, no photographs. Mm. I eventually managed to unearth a photograph of my father with his first wife and my half-sister, mm-hmm. and sitting in front of an old, some kind of old car, and a friend of mine did a painting based on that, but put me in the painting,
oh,
because
wow.
I didn't have any images of myself with my dad. So, you know, it's this, you know, trying to construct these fake memories, you know, my entire life. So he was a country music musician, and I knew that, and he had made records, and I had searched my entire life for record. He died at home of a massive coronary, and I was in my bedroom, and which was adjacent to the bathroom, and it was such a volcanic physical experience, and the sounds were so frightening. And that's the only sound I had of my father, was the convulsive sound of him dying. And as I grew older, that became even more ironic to me, that here was a man who was a musician and who had made records, and the only sound I knew was of him dying. Mm. So I searched for a very long time for a recording and couldn't find one, and haunted. You know, in the advent of eBay, I'm like, now I'll certainly find it. And no, nothing. And so a few months ago, I'm in my studio and the phone rings, and it's my lecture agent, and she says, I found the most amazing email in my spam folder, and I'm so glad I found it because it's directed to you. I had no idea what she's talking about, and she starts to read it. And this man had found a record that my father recorded of a song he had written and wanted me to have it. I literally fell to the floor. And I didn't say anything, but she's like, Connie Mae, are you still there? And I couldn't speak. And, so it was quite the gift.
Yeah. And so I'm curious if now that you have that recording, and he also reconstructed the album cover for you
He did. He reconstructed the album cover, and I have, of course, it has the 78 has the Gator Records label on it, and he went so far as to, because he knew my father, and he had a memory that he shared of my father and the band rolling up in some old, very styled out Cadillac and just kind of all of them coming out with their instruments onto the green in St. Augustine and putting on a show, and how impressed he was by that. But he even included a color photocopy of a car that looked like the car that my father's band had.
That's so nice. What a gift.
Yeah, it was amazing.
It's wild because you specifically were looking for something just like this.
And the universe just said, okay.
Here.
You've looked long enough.
So the last part of that question that I wanted to ask you is, do you find yourself drawn to writing about your father now?
I think because, you know, I mean, I keep re-listening to the recording and discovering new things. And I've learned that memory and writing, family stories, it's a lot like religion. You know, you just have to believe, and when you don't, you're lost. I mean, I have to believe in my family stories, and so, you know, and so I believe that what I hear in his voice is accurate and true. I mean, that's just the way it's going to be.
Yeah.
And so I think that what will happen is that this character I keep rewriting in books that is a shadow figure of my father will change, will become more fleshed out, a kinder person.
Yeah. What are you working on now?
I'm working on an ecological memoir. I've been wanting to write something about this place I live, because I call it the edge of the world, and it's a sandbar. I mean, it sticks out into the northern Gulf of Mexico. It's a few miles long and about 300 feet wide. The first time I saw it, I was passing on the highway, and I look out, and there are these homes that look like they're rising out of the water. I'm like, oh, those people are so screwed. And then I went, because, you know, it's got this great name, and I got there, and I just fell in love with it. So, you know, and I've grown crops out there, and you know, out of the sand, I've grown books and gardens and dogs and relationships, children, and so that was my idea, sort of a writer's life, and how you, out of nothingness, you know, and the sand of the place being that metaphor, how do you create this life and create works of art? And then the oil gusher happened, and that changed everything.
Yeah.
It's made the memoir much more immediate to me, urgent. It's made it very urgent. I have to write it more quickly than I had planned, because it's very, very hard to now live in a place that was so beautiful, so abundant and full of life, and see what's happening.
Yeah.
And the pain and despair and anger that we're all experiencing down there, and the fear too, because we don't know how do we go forward in the middle of this. I mean, how do we rebuild lives and businesses, and if the Gulf becomes a dead zone, we don't know what to do. It's truly a disaster of epic proportions, and it's difficult. You know, you watch a pelican fly by, and you pray that the next time you see him, he's not oiled. And things that happen with the sea turtles are just so haunting and painful. So part of it is, you know, how do you deal with that kind of pain, and how do you separate yourself from a place you love?
My sister lives in New Orleans, and she says she doesn't live in the city. She lives in Pearl River, Louisiana. And she says she walks out her door and she smells oil. Do you have that too?
Yeah, well, you know, we're a little further to the east, and so there are hints of it. And so it's sort of like, you know, I'll email my neighbor and go, do you smell that? You know, and he lives a mile down the road, so I don't just go out and ask. There's times when we're sure that we do, and then we go, oh no, we're imagining it. We're just so upset that we're imagining that's happening. But I'm sure in New Orleans they are.
Mm-hmm. How far were you into your memoir of place before this happened?
You know, I was at the very beginning. I mean, I've been walking around with it in my head for a long time, but I had been writing it for about 3 months.
Mm.
And I'm not sure, you know, that those early moments in writing any book are kind of tenuous, and you're learning structure and story and how you want to tell it. And that was all coming together, and I was starting to have confidence in it. And then this happened and changed the whole approach.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me of when Stephen King wrote his memoir, and the first half is sort of about his life and about his writing, and then he gets hit by that car, The whole second half of the memoir is totally different. It's really interesting. Okay. Can you talk a little bit about what writers have influenced you, either personally or through their works?
I love poetry, and I think I started life as a poet, and I still read a lot of poetry. And I actually see my novels as long-form poems, and the books I tend to gravitate to are books where you just read the first sentence, and you know you're reading a poet. Mm-hmm. And that's people like Louise Erdrich. Love Medicine was a huge influence on me because it was when I was first trying to write Sugar Cage. That was my graduate school thesis. And I'm like, I have no idea how to write a novel. This is insane. Why did they tell me to do this? And I read that book and was like, yes, I can. I can do it. I was like the little engine that could. And it was because it's episodic. It's almost, not exactly, but it's almost like strung short stories so that I could see myself doing, you know, chunk, 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 because the idea of an entire novel was so overwhelming. But I continue to read and love her work. Michael Ondaatje's work is really been influential. And, you know, and Usual Suspects like Eudora Welty and Flannery O'Connor and Faulkner, coming from where I come from. But I love Pablo Neruda before anybody in the States knew who he was.
You were his first fan.
That's right. Octavio Paz, Federico Garcia Lorca. The imagist poets I really am attracted to.
Yeah, great. And are you reading anything right now?
You know what? I'm rereading, because of the book I'm working on, I'm rereading Annie Dillard's Pilgrim at Tinker Creek.
I'm curious if you get feedback from anyone before you submit work to an agent or an editor.
I usually don't. I was talking to a student about that recently. Sometimes I think we share work too early.
Mm.
I think that there's a lot to be said for holding on to it and letting it grow up and mature for a while in your mind before you start hearing, but letting other people muck around with it. It's, you know, if you're having a baby, are you going to just suddenly, you know, let other people start influencing its growth while it's in the womb? No. So I don't think you should do that as an artist either. But for with Clarissa, I kept rewriting the first 50 pages over and over and over. I'm like, okay, I gotta, something's gotta give here. And so I have a good friend, he just died, but he's a poet, and I sent the first 50 to him, and he said, you wrote the entire novel in 50 pages. I'm like, oh my goodness, you're right. And so the process of then writing the novel was to take those 50 and just expand them, pull them out, stretch them out. But I have, you know, a great reader in my agent, and I have a great reader in my editor, so I'm very blessed that way.
Mm.
But, I mean, I think if you can find someone you really trust who doesn't want to turn it into their book, but is just a solid, solid reader, and who can ask questions that will get you thinking, it's almost like prompts to help you solve problems that might be in the manuscript, I think that's a great thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But a whole, you know, I've just seen people send work too early, and they get bad advice, and it mucks up the work.
It probably interrupts that organic process you were talking about.
I think so.
Okay, great. So my last question is, what advice might you have for writers who sometimes get stuck in their work or have trouble moving forward or get writer's block?
I think that you, there are a couple of things that you need to do, and one is to read. I mean, when I was writing Clarissa, I had a shadow book, which is Mrs. Dalloway, and every morning I would get up, terrified that I wasn't going to be able to pull this off, and I would open up the pages of Virginia Woolf's book and just be amazed at what she did, but it would also center me and focus me and get me to that zone that I need to be to write in. Mm-hmm. And then I could put down Mrs. Dalloway and start my own work. So I think that continuing to go back to other people's work that you admire, especially a book that's going to inspire the pages you're writing, is always a good thing to do. And I think sometimes you just have to write through it. Not everything you write is going to be brilliant.
Right.
You know, a lot of it will not be. But you're never going to get to that spot if you don't keep writing. We put words together as our art instead of you stop putting the words together. It's as if you give into that thing called writer's block mm-hmm. instead of pushing through it.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That, once again, was a conversation with Connie Mae Fowler. To learn more about Connie Mae, you can check out her website, conniemaefowler.com. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group and host of the annual Autism Walk, each October at Battery Park. More information is available at autismsupportdaily.com or 802-985-8773. And by the Lake Champlain Regional Chamber of Commerce, promoting and supporting a healthy environment that makes Burlington the ideal place to live, work, visit, and do business, located at 60 Main Street in Burlington and online at vermont.org. And by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, building a brand new economy with old-fashioned values. Learn more at vbsr.org. And by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world, internet, television, telephone. BurlingtonTelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic network. I've just got one item for the Bookworm's calendar this week. Writer and poet Michelle Demers offers a summer writing studio every Monday through Thursday, 6:30 to 8:30, from now through August 10th. These Williston-based studio sessions give participants a chance to brainstorm, write, and share ideas. More information is available at demersmichelle@gmail.com. That's demersmichelle@gmail.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Connie Mae Fowler, whose latest novel, How Clarissa Burden Learned to Fly, involves the ghosts of women who reside in a graveyard. Connie Mae Fowler recommends walking through a cemetery in your own area and finding a tombstone that inspires you, then writing a story or poem inspired by that tombstone and the person whose grave it marks. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can check out upcoming shows by looking at my blog, writethebook.wordpress.com. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. Stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby brings you the world of music at 3 o'clock. I'm closing out the show today with a recording of Connie Mae Fowler's father and his band, Henry May and his Rhythm Ramblers, playing The Moon Reminds Me of Your Smile. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont.
My dreams are all broken, you took them with you. The vow that you made are broken too. The smile you said you liked about me. Oh, sweetheart, that smile was just for you. Oh, it's so lonely here without you. When the whippoorwills are singing in the pines. Oh, the stars up above are like your eyes, dear. And the moon remind me of your smile. I remember when Uncle Sammy called me, and I said, my darling, I'll have to go. You promised that you'd wait for me, love, that I was your one and only beau. love and all the things he means to you. Please keep those vows this time, my darling. Then you'll have a love I wished I knew. Oh, it's so lonely here without you. When the whippoorwills are singing in the pines, oh, the stars up above are like your eyes, dear. And the moon reminds me of you.